Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tim Edgar, legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, who summarizes his group's lawsuit targeting key provisions of the USA Patriot Act. Catherine Hoyt, co-coordinator with the Nicaragua Network, who discusses the plight of Nicaragua's impoverished coffee workers now demanding the government take action on land reform. And journalist and author Mika Seyfry, who takes a look at California's circus-like gubernatorial recall election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 6 years of off and on again negotiations, the United Nations and Cambodia have signed a deal to create a special court to try those most responsible for Cambodia's infamous killing fields in the late 1970s. While France and Japan have agreed to pay for 2 years of the tribunal of top Khmer Rouge leaders, there is a growing level of skepticism from human rights groups like Amnesty International. According to the news magazine In These Times, Cambodia's Prime Minister Hun Sen, a former Khmer Rouge foot soldier, is running for re-election, and many Western observers feel he doesn't have the commitment to a full-scale war crimes investigation. Critics are also worried the assassination earlier this year of two of Cambodia's most powerful judges will limit the number of people willing to sit on a jury. The United States will not participate in the tribunal because of an amendment passed in 2002 by U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell that prevents funding a Cambodian inquiry without a request by President Bush for such funding. For longtime Cambodia watchers, there is a fear that lower-level Khmer Rouge killers will go free. As Craig Etchison, a scholar of the killing fields, lamented, if a handful of senior cadres are prosecuted, you're going to have a lot of people wondering why their own personal Pol Pot is not getting any of this so-called justice. As they gathered for Sunday dinner, Belfast civil rights attorney Patrick Finucane was brutally shot and killed in front of his wife and children. That was 14 years ago. According to the Boston Globe, Finucane was a high-profile lawyer who defended unionists like Bobby Sands, who died in a hunger strike in a British prison in 1981. In 1988, Finucane agreed to represent Patrick McEwen, a volunteer with the Irish Republican Army, who was charged with lynching two British soldiers who stumbled upon an IRA funeral procession and was able to get the charges dropped. Today, investigators for the Finucane family and British-Irish Rights Watch claim the British government and its informants in the Loyalist paramilitaries were responsible for the murder of the civil rights lawyer. In response to the growing pressure in the case, the British government arrested Ken Bennett in June, a member of the Ulster Freedom Fighters paramilitary group for shooting Finucane. Last year, the BBC broadcast a documentary showing Bennett boasting about his role in the Finucane murder with other UFF soldiers, including William Stobie, who was admitted to being an informer for the special branch of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the British police force in Northern Ireland. Stobie was later assassinated after he agreed to cooperate with a public inquiry into Finucane's murder. The Boston Globe reports that time is running out for hundreds of Florida inmates as they face an October 1st deadline for filing a claim of innocence through DNA testing. In recent years, 25 people on Florida's death row have been exonerated through the use of DNA tests. The last person released had been on death row for 16 years, but his conviction was tainted by sloppy police work and questionable witnesses. Death penalty opponents say there are at least 10 other cases in Florida where an inmate has a good chance of proving their innocence. But the impending deadline is placing intense pressure on death penalty lawyers. The Innocence Project, based in New York City, has received over 1,000 requests for assistance from Florida, where there are currently 368 people on death row. Lawyers with the Innocence Project and a team at the Florida State University Law School say the deadline needs to be extended to prevent thousands of prisoners from losing their right to DNA tests. So far, Florida Governor Jeb Bush has resisted any call for a death penalty moratorium or appointing a commission to overhaul the system of capital punishment. Bush's spokesman says the state has adequate safeguards to prevent anyone from being wrongfully convicted. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
In what may become a landmark case in constitutional law, the American Civil Liberties Union filed the first legal challenge to the USA Patriot Act on July 30th. The ACLU suit targets Section 215 of the law, which empowers the FBI to search the records and property belonging to innocent U.S. citizens and legal immigrants. The case was filed on behalf of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and several other secular and religious organizations representing Arabic, South Asian, and Islamic communities whose members have been frequent subjects of investigation under the Patriot Act. The legislation, pushed by the Bush administration and passed by Congress with little debate shortly after the September 11th terrorist attacks, granted unprecedented powers to the Justice Department and U.S. intelligence agencies. But the Patriot Act has come under increasing attack for what many view as the law's undermining of constitutionally guaranteed rights and protections. The GOP-controlled House of Representatives recently voted overwhelmingly to prevent the Justice Department from engaging in secret sneak-and-peek searches of people's homes. Nearly 150 communities in 27 states across the country have passed resolutions opposing the Patriot Act. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tim Edgar, legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, who explains why his group initiated the lawsuit against the Patriot Act.
It is aimed at one section of the law, Section 215, and the reason we've targeted that section of very broad anti-terrorism law is that it is the one that really undermines personal privacy in perhaps the most egregious manner. Under Section 215, the FBI can obtain an order for any tangible thing, and that can be books, documents, records of your library reading habits, your emails, your medical files, the files that are contained in the office of an organization you work for, literally anything, as long as they specify to the judge of a secret court that they're using that information to protect against international terrorism. We're very concerned that with that kind of carte blanche to rifle through personal records, that there could be a chilling effect on legitimate First Amendment activity, on the activities of community organizations and others who question government policy, because now the government has this unprecedented power without probable cause of crime or even the lower standard of probable cause or reasonable suspicion that used to apply to intelligence surveillance before the Patriot Act, that under this new provision of the Patriot Act, they can get all of these records really without having to do anything other than specify themselves that they intend to use them to protect against terrorism.
Could you give us examples of how the FBI and the Justice Department have targeted groups and individuals with these provisions contained in the USA Patriot Act?
You know, I get a lot of these questions, and the only real honest answer to that question is I don't know specifically, because the information is completely classified. Congress and our organization filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, found out just how Section 215 is being used, and we were rebuffed, essentially, on the grounds that the investigation of international terrorism is under the Foreign Intelligence Act is completely classified. And Congress has asked similar questions, and although the government has made available some information to the intelligence committees, only those who have special clearances can go and look at it. What we do know publicly is that many members of the community organizations that we represent have been targeted by the FBI. They've been visited and interrogated by FBI agents about their political and religious views. Many immigrants have been subject to special registration, which is a process where they have to go in and be fingerprinted and answer lengthy questions sometimes from FBI agents about all sorts of subjects, including their feelings about the war in Iraq and how often they attend mosques or if they attend other religious institutions. So we're pretty comfortable with the fact that people are reasonably afraid of what the government is going to find out about them. We know that people have already been chilled in exercising their First Amendment rights, and we know because they've told us that they're afraid to go to mosque regularly or to write letters critical of the government to the newspaper or to engage in other activities that are protected by the First Amendment because they fear that the government will target them for investigation as a result of that.
Tim Edgar, the FBI, I'm sure, would argue that innocent people may be targeted, but this is all done in the cause necessary to prevent terrorism, future acts of terrorism after September 11th. How do you respond to the whole idea of balancing national security with our traditional liberties here in this country?
I believe it was Louis Brandeis, may have been another Supreme Court justice, who said that the greatest threat to liberty comes from men of zeal who are well-meaning but lack understanding. Clearly, you know, the excesses that we look back into in our history are the result of people that were well-meaning and that did want to protect Americans against foreign threats, threats of communism or fascism or other things that were perceived as terrible dangers back then and were, in fact, dangerous. Yet we know, looking back on it, that we made some terrible mistakes there. And so I think that we in America have come to believe, really it's something that we were founded on, that it's checks and balances that keep our liberties in check, that we don't just trust the government to say, well, we do have this sweeping power to obtain records, but you can trust us to use it well, that we're not going to go after people based on their political views. We're really intent only on getting the terrorists. That's an argument that's based on trusting the not a system of checks and balances that's set up, but trusting the goodwill of the people that are administering the law. And I think that it's just not an appropriate philosophy in our system.
What's at stake, in your view, for American democracy and our constitutional civil liberties with challenges such as yours, your current lawsuit here on the USA Patriot Act?
If we're successful in raising these issues and convincing the court to declare this unconstitutional or Congress to repeal these laws, that we will be, again, sending a strong signal to the government that we all support its efforts to find terrorists, but we think that it's important that it act within the existing boundaries of law and the Constitution in doing that, and that it's important to sort of nip that in the bud and not to wait around for 20 years until we go and learn that secretly these things were happening and nobody knew about them. Well, unfortunately, we find out about these kinds of abuses often too late to stop them from happening. We're hoping that with this lawsuit and with our continuing education campaign that we'll be able to reverse that and we'll be able to stop the erosions in our civil liberties from turning into a full-blown disaster as we saw in the McCarthy era.
That was Tim Edgar, legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. Contact the ACLU by calling area code 212-549-2500 or visit their website at www.aclu.org. After a decade of war in the 1980s, followed by another decade of government policies that favor the wealthy over the poor, Nicaragua is now the Western Hemisphere's second poorest country after Haiti. One desperate group, the landless coffee workers of the mountainous Matagalpa region, focused attention on their plight by undertaking a march in late July from Matagalpa to the capital of Managua. Failed land reform policies and a steep drop in world coffee prices has created a situation where people, especially children, are now dying of hunger. The marchers demanded that Nicaraguan President Enrique Bolaños honor promises he made to the coffee workers last year to allocate state-owned land to their families. Instead, he handed out food packages. This year's march ended after workers walked one-third of the way to Managua when Bolaños again agreed to distribute government land. Catherine Hoyt is the co-coordinator with the Nicaraguan Network, a coalition of groups working in solidarity with the people of Nicaragua. She describes the dire situation of the workers and their families and says the Nicaraguan government must be held to its promises.
This is the third year now that the coffee has been bringing on the world market less than what it costs for production, so that the coffee growers, whether they're small farmers or large plantation owners, don't employ anywhere near the number of workers that they used. I mean, it would normally takes hundreds of thousands of workers to harvest the coffee in Nicaragua, and they just don't hire that many. And then they paid them with food, and that was all they got for this year. And so now there are thousands of people in Nicaragua who are without any source of income. 14 people died, and the alarm over the death of these people motivated them to begin their march, and then a couple more children died on the march. In one case, it was a whole family, a mother, a father, and two children, all died of starvation, unemployed coffee worker families.
This was before the march started? Or
right before the march.
Describe a little bit what the lives of these workers are like. Do they own their own land, or are they just workers on other people's property?
These are coffee workers who don't have land of their own. The ones who do have land at least are able to plant. Even if coffee isn't bringing a decent price, they can use that land to plant other crops. These are people who depend each year on the coffee harvest to provide them with enough money to survive for the year. And that's the basic problem, and that was their demand to President Bolaños as part of the march. They wanted not just food, but they want land in order to grow food for their families. And President Bolaños had signed an agreement with them almost a year ago, 10 months ago, the previous time that they started marching from Matagalpa down towards Managua. They got to exactly the same place called Las Tunas on about 25 miles into what would be a 75-mile walk. Then the government sent people again to talk with them. And the problem comes whether the government will fulfill the promises that it made in this agreement any more than it did last year's agreement, which the government did not keep the promises for land that it made last year. This year, they are going to give them some coffee farms that are not planted at all to coffee, but that have coffee on them, 2,500 families, which probably will take care of between 5,000 and 6,000 marchers, and that they will be buying on what seem to be pretty good terms, several years of grace and no interest and quite a few years to pay them, if the government will actually move forward and get them on the land. Is they're getting some farms that have been in government hands that will be provided for, that they will be able to purchase, and each family will get land on those farms. It's always very hard, you know, for agriculture, for people with very small or no capital to buy the equipment and supplies that they need to keep a small plot of land going, especially if the price of coffee starts to go up and there is coffee on these farms. They can make enough money, but also at the same time they can grow corn and beans and vegetables for their families. Now, we as Nicaragua Network are supporting a project which could be seen as a pilot project where a small foundation, folks from Matagalpa, now 70 families, gotten funding from us and from other sources to put these people back on land that has been donated to the foundation for 10 years, for the use for 10 years. And the people are growing corn and beans, and they had terrific harvests last year. And I understand the rains have been so bad this year that the beans were washed out, but the corn is okay. So we're hoping we help them get oxen this year, and hopefully the oxen were plowed successfully.
The coffee that's grown there, is any of it are currently like shade-grown organic coffee, or is it the kind that you strip the land and...
No, it's the old-fashioned kind, and that's why Nicaragua has some kind of a future in coffee. More of it is shade-grown because it's not appropriate to grow the coffee in rows where you can bring in machines for harvesting or anything like that. It's on steep hills, and more of it is being grown organically, and there are a lot of co-ops that are registering with the fair trade systems.
That was Catherine Hoyt of the Nicaragua Network. For more information or to take action in support of the coffee workers' demands, call the network at area code 202-544-9355 or visit the group's website at www.nicanet.org. With the required number of signatures collected, California, in economic freefall, is set to hold a rare election to recall its governor October 7th. The goal of the campaign, funded by wealthy Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, is to oust unpopular Democratic Governor Gray Davis. Although many states are facing economic crises and record deficits, California's budget shortfall is a whopping $35 billion, a deficit caused in part by manipulation of the deregulated energy market by companies like Enron. Californians will be asked to vote yes or no on recalling Davis and given a choice of nearly 200 candidates to replace him. A media circus erupted after multimillionaire actor Arnold Schwarzenegger announced on The Tonight Show that he would be running as a Republican. Others filing papers to replace Davis are Democratic Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante, independent commentator Arianna Huffington, former GOP gubernatorial candidate Bill Simon Jr., former baseball commissioner and 1984 Olympic organizer Peter Ueberroth running as a Republican, Green Party candidate Peter Camejo, and pornographic publisher Larry Flint. Although many Californians are not happy about the estimated $60 million it will take to run this complex election, public opinion polls predict that unless voter sentiment changes, Gray Davis may well be unemployed come October. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Mika Seyfry, who frequently writes about voter disenchantment with the political status quo. He takes a look at the issues which led to California's recall election and the choices available for progressives.
Gray Davis, the Democratic governor who won re-election in 2002, is very unpopular for a couple of reasons. Number one, he mishandled the state's energy crisis and saw a state that had a budget surplus go into severe deficit while consumers were hit with skyrocketing utility bills. And now some of this is, by the way, not his fault. It's also the fault of companies like Enron that were involved in fixing prices in the California market, and people like the Bush administration who were not stepping in with the federal regulatory powers to prevent this price fixing. They actually said that the jump in prices was the normal workings of the market, and only now have the documents and the emails come out showing that Enron and other energy companies were manipulating the California market. But Gray Davis gets the blame because he was the guy in charge at the time. And he's just a very unpopular guy, because, in particular because of an abrasive personality and a plain tendency to sell politics to the highest bidder. And even though he's a Democrat, there are very few Democrats who love him. His lieutenant governor despises him. He has few friends. But he won election in 2002, he won re-election because he was running against a bumbling Republican named Bill Simon, who ran one of the worst campaigns in political history in the state. And even with that, Simon still managed to get 44% of the vote. He was sort of embarrassed by how weak his victory was in 2002. And I think the conservatives who have bankrolled this recall campaign smelled blood in the water. So all of this comes together in this perfect storm, and the recall has qualified for the ballot, and as everybody knows, it has attracted a huge crowd of both serious and unserious candidates. And for the next 2 months, this is all people who are following politics are going to be talking about, the meltdown in California.
With nearly 200 candidates filing to run in this recall election, obviously, Arnold Schwarzenegger has gotten the most attention because of his Hollywood status and his recent hit movie, Terminator 3. But maybe you could make a brief comment about Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's billed in the corporate media as a moderate Republican, married to a Kennedy, of course. What is he about? Do we know?
Well, we don't know very much about him yet. He has not spelled out any positions on how he would close the state's budget deficit. Really, we know very little. The scuttlebutt is that Arnold is a liberal on choice and on things like gay rights. And for that very reason, the religious right in California is nervous about him. And Rush Limbaugh, of all people, just said that people shouldn't assume right away that this guy is a rock-ribbed conservative in the mold of Ronald Reagan. So Arnold is going to hit some rough water, on at least from the right in California. And at the same time, there are plenty of other candidates in this race that will nip away at him. And I can't imagine what a ballot with 150 names on it is going to look like and what kind of a mess it's going to be simply for people to wade through that ballot. It actually occurred to me that if I were a undecided voter coming in to vote and I simply saw this incredibly long ballot, it might make me think twice about the dignity of this whole experiment. But on the other hand, there's a lot of support, I think, in America for more direct democracy, even if it's not all that rational in its form. I mean, for starters, when you have a multi-candidate election like the one they're going to have in California, they ought to be using something called instant runoff voting. Instead, what we'll have in California is the potential scene of somebody getting elected there with, say, 15-18% of the vote. And this is going to be very strange, because if Gray Davis loses the recall vote but still gets, say, 48% saying no, and then Arnold Schwarzenegger wins the governor's office with 18% of the vote, in effect, you'll have a new governor of California who got less votes of support than the governor who was just recalled.
Very strange.
It's going to be very strange. And to make it even stranger, you've already got people like Gray Davis suggesting that if it works, and if the Republicans, who after all got this ball rolling, succeed in knocking Davis out, there will probably be Democrats saying, well, heck, let's just turn the tables on these guys and recall whoever gets elected governor as soon as that person's honeymoon is over. It's a recipe for permanent chaos.
Mika Seifert, between people like Cruz Bustamante, Arianna Huffington, Peter Camejo of the Green Party, do progressives have any possibility that they will be able to get behind a candidate here and replace Gray Davis with somebody more to their liking?
Bustamante's politics are better than Davis's, and he is the top elected Latino in the state, and it would be, you know, a step forward if he became governor, and I think that will certainly be to his benefit in this fight, his base in the Latino community. But then you have Arianna Huffington, who is running as an independent, and Arianna, we believe, had an understanding with the Green Party's candidate, Peter Camejo. There is a chance that Camejo might throw his support to Arianna Huffington. I think that they obviously like each other, and they agree on many things. Those two combined could be a factor. For progressives in California who aren't going crazy, the first thing is to demand, you know, some bottom lines from all the candidates and see if you can force them to all sing from the same choir book. And that's the value of candidates like Huffington and Camejo being in the race. I mean, considering how fractured it is, and it's not as if Schwarzenegger is not dealing with threats on his right, it's not a simple three-party race such as the one that took place in 2000.
That was journalist and author Mika Seifert. His book, Spoiling for a Fight, Third-Party Politics in America, is published by Routledge. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.